Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. You have a Democratic ticket. It is Tim Walz of Minnesota. I think it is a solid pick. It's in some ways a cautious pick because there's absolutely nothing not to like about this guy. He is a solid Midwesterner. He has a long military record. He has been governor. He has a record of executive experience. He is magnificent on media, and he kind of balances the ticket in the same way that I think Biden balanced Obama's ticket. What do I mean by that? Although he's the same age, he looks a little bit older. He is not a coastal elite. He's not a lawyer. He grew up in small town or rural America where Republicans have dominated until now. He was a football coach. He's about unlike the stereotypical Democrat that Republicans like to make fun of. He is, in a word, what J.D. Vance pretends to be: authentic, nice guy, America's dad. So is it a good pick? Absolutely. I think it's a solid pick. You will not find Democrats who have really any complaint with him. He's going to have some crossover appeal to independents and maybe even some Republicans. Now, what about the other candidates? Well, I think it was clear that she wanted executive experience. And in fact, it did come down, I believe, to Walz and Shapiro. What about Shapiro? There was a malicious campaign, is the only way I can describe it, from far-left anti-Semites, suggesting that he was too pro-Israel or that he was going to be a problem for the ticket or would cause dissension in Democratic ranks. That was all bunk. He has a position on Israel that is no different than Kamala Harris's and no different than Walz's. So if the aim was to keep someone who is pro-Israel off the ticket, they failed miserably. But Shapiro did offer, at least theoretically, the potential to deliver Pennsylvania, which is an absolutely critical state. But take a step back. What does that really mean? Does it mean that Pennsylvanians wouldn't vote for her without Shapiro on the ticket? Are there that many voters really who would choose a ticket with the governor in the number two spot as opposed to without? I don't know about that. And moreover, Walz does something that Shapiro maybe doesn't do as well. And that is he cuts down on Republicans' advantage in rural areas. Pennsylvania's been described as Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with Alabama in between, meaning rural, conservative, gun owning. Well, you have a guy who's a rural gun owner in Walz, so he can certainly help there. And I think he can help in comparable areas in Wisconsin and Michigan, places that they have to do well. So I'm not sure that Pennsylvania was a lock with Shapiro on the ticket. It was going to be won by the, and it is going to be won by the top of the ticket. And while Shapiro is a very gifted politician, as governor, he can help deliver the state as well. He can turn over his political machine. He can campaign throughout the state with the ticket. So I'm not sure that they lose Pennsylvania or they put Pennsylvania more in play than it already was. I think Pennsylvania is very gettable for the Democratic ticket. Now, how does he match up Walz against J.D. Vance? Just saying it is kind of funny, I admit, because Vance is a complete phony. He's changed his mind on everything. He used to think that Trump was a Hitler figure, and now he has nothing bad to say about him. He was a critic of the whole MAGA movement, and now he's the choir boy of the MAGA movement. He is a phony. There is something off-putting and, yes, weird about him. He is a devotee of this new right philosophy that's embodied in the 2025 project. He's an extremist. And he's mean, and he's kind of grotesque in the people that he attacks, you know, single women with cats. What is that all about? So when you see the two of them on the stage, you can just imagine Vance trying to do his shtick about how Democrats are un-American or weird, or they're going to bring down civilization. And Walz is going to turn to him and say, get a load of this guy. He's a creep. Who wants to have him in the White House for 4 years? So I think he has a disarming ability to call the bluff of Republicans. And sometimes I think Democrats do make it too difficult. They rely too much on policy and not enough on just the kind of gut ambience of a ticket that is now thoroughly weird, thoroughly out of touch with America, is reduced to nothing more than race baiting and misogyny. So I think all in all, it was a very solid pick. And what I'm most impressed with is the process. How diligent she was. She was operating under unusual time restraints. Usually this process takes months and months. There were no leaks. We did not find out about the nominee, the potential nominee for vice president, until 3 hours before their first appearance. I don't think we've ever had as buttoned up an operation before. She clearly narrowed the field to the best possible picks. And I think she chose someone who, as she said, is going to be a partner, is going to be part of a team. She has said that she values loyalty, she values executive experience. And I think that's what she has. So is it a good pick? Absolutely. Is it going to continue the momentum of the Harris campaign? Absolutely. And you can see, if you are so inclined, I'm not, but if it makes you feel better, take a look at the polls. They're shifting slowly, methodically in her direction. And we've yet to have the Democratic primary. And we've yet to see this tour in which she and Walz are going to go out around the country to each one of the swing states. Going to generate a lot of press, going to generate a lot of local media. So I think there's plenty to be optimistic about. Democrats, however, cannot coast. Just because Trump seems even more degenerated, even more weird, even more irrational, even more racist, does not necessarily mean that Democrats have this in the bag. Au contraire. Let's be honest. Republicans are going to try to steal this election. They are going to try to suppress the vote. They are going to make a whole variety of bogus legal claims when they lose. And so we return to my adage. If it's not close, they can't cheat. So it's essential not only that Harris-Walz win, but that they win comfortably. Comfortably enough to avoid these phony controversies about the vote, and strong enough to bring Democrats into the House and the Senate so they can get going on a real agenda. Wow, what a day today. We've had the announcement of Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, as the running mate. So what does that mean? What does that do for Kamala Harris? What does it do for Democrats? Well, I've got the perfect guest to explain that. We have with us today Matt Bennett, who is the head of the Third Way. Third Way is a think tank and a political action group. They are center-left in orientation. They were very instrumental in getting rid of, frankly, of No Labels as a competitor for the votes. And they've done great work. And I'll ask them about that. I'm going to ask them about some of the research they have done, which tells us really where the American people are on a lot of these issues, like environment, like abortion, and whether the Republicans are going to be able to paint Kamala Harris and Tim Walz as some kind of weirdo, some kind of extremist. Frankly, I think Tim Walz was perhaps not the most expected person in the race, but what does he do for her? Are there voters that she can reach that perhaps other choices couldn't, like Governor Shapiro, who's the governor of Pennsylvania? I really want to kind of know what the vibe is that he gives off, what he helps Democrats with, and also what Democrats should watch out for. People are riding very high right now, but there is no smooth road to the presidency, and people make mistakes, and people get caught up in lines of argument that are not necessarily helpful. So I want to ask Matt about that, and just get his general read on, really, how does the party feel these days? As he has mentioned to me many a time, it used to feel like the Democratic Party was driving to a funeral in Chicago. Maybe we're driving to a wedding. Who knows? Hopefully it'll be a happy marriage. So I'm delighted to have as our guest, Matt Bennett from Third Way. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It is an important day. We're recording this on Tuesday, and Tim Walz has just been named as the vice presidential nominee. First of all, do you know him personally? Have you met him? Are you familiar with him?
I met him when he was in Congress, but I wouldn't say I know him, but he's exactly what you think he is, friendly, avuncular, nice guy.
And what do you think he brings to the ticket that maybe some of the others didn't, or simply that he does better than some of the others who are under consideration?
Well, I don't know exactly why she chose to go this direction. We probably never will know. She probably, it was just a confluence of things. But clearly what he brings is this very friendly guy next door vibe. And I think that's very important. He is a very normal person. He's a football coach, and he repairs cars, and he goes ice fishing, and he goes to the fair. And he's just a good dude, and he's very recognizable to most people. And I love the contrast between that, this kind of nice favorite uncle vibe, and J.D. Vance, who has spent the last 3 weeks explaining away, or trying to explain away, his incredibly nasty, negative, biting commentary that he makes about his friends and neighbors. And so I think that matchup looks pretty good. The other thing he brings is a pretty well-rounded resume in government. I mean, he spent a bunch of years in Congress. He's now been a very successful governor in a Midwestern state. They've done a whole bunch of things. Minnesota works really, really well. And so I think he brings a lot to this ticket.
And 24 years of military service as a commissioned guy who really was kind of there with his men. He wasn't a PR guy in Iraq as J.D. Vance was. I don't want to diminish that. But this was a guy who was in the service for 24 years. And as I understand it, had some hearing loss because he was in the artillery and suffered what many of these guys do from these loud blasts, which loss of hearing.
Exactly. He was a command sergeant major, which is an incredibly high rank in the enlisted service. And he also was a teacher. I mean, this guy couldn't be more relatable. He is about, if you created someone with a chemistry set to make them a relatable politician, you would come up with Tim Walz.
Our mutual friend, John Avalon, who's now running for Congress, made a great point on social media earlier today. He said, this is a guy who really helps bridge the rural-urban divide. And I thought it was a super insightful comment. Let's talk about two aspects of that. One is helping the ticket / Democratic Party, and then on the other hand, helping the country. So talk a little bit about the ticket and Democrats and where they need help and what they need help with in relating to voters that they've not done very well with. Even if they may not win a majority of those voters, they can and should do better with them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Minneapolis is a very rural state. It's got a couple of big cities in it, of course, but has huge swaths of pretty sparsely populated areas. And he served on the Agriculture Committee in Congress. he has thought deeply about the questions relating to small town America and our farming communities. And he really understands how tough it is to get by as a dairy farmer or a, you know, whatever kind of agriculture you're trying to pursue. Unless you're on a big factory farm now, it's really, really hard. And I think Walls really understands that. And he brings a kind of, as we discussed, a kind of level of everyday sensibility, the kind of guy that you could talk to if you were sitting with him in a diner, to his politics. And I think that's very important. This isn't to say that suddenly the Harris ticket is going to magically turn around decades of loss that we've been suffering with rural voters. We're not. But there's a huge difference between losing by 60 and losing by 70. And that difference is between winning and losing the election. And I think that Walls can really help stem the bleeding. He can win some votes of people who are deeply skeptical of Trump, but maybe a little bit queasy about Democrats and reassured by a guy like Walls. And then he also has thought and dealt carefully with urban issues. I mean, he was governor during the Black Lives Matter protests in Minneapolis, and he has managed his way through those crises. And the city and the state are doing extraordinarily well. CNBC ranked Minnesota as the sixth best state in which to do business in the United States. So I think he can talk the talk on in both kinds of places.
The other aspect I think that our friend John Avalon was talking about was the country as a whole, which he points out is maybe more profound than red and blue states, because we have purple and blue states with many places in between that are rural or small town America. The big example being Pennsylvania, which has been characterized as Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Alabama in between, perhaps not fair to either Alabama or Pennsylvania. But the point being is that we think of one another, those in urban America and those in rural America, we think of each other as freaks, as stereotypes, as people. If you're looking from urban America, oh, those people don't care about education, or those people are intolerant. He goes a long way to kind of breaking down those stereotypes and making the portrait of Americans much less black and white, I think, than it has been. Talk to us a little bit about that ability and kind of what you think is a message or an attitude that might, beyond the election, help solve some of these divides and this animosity that has grown up.
I mean, it's been a long time since Democrats have had on the ticket somebody that could appear on a football podcast as a color commentator. I mean, he really knows what he's talking about. And he can talk about cars, and he can talk about the things that normal people who don't obsess over politics all day, and apparently there are people like that, Jen, I'm told. But in fact, that's most people. He really can relate to them because that is how he has lived his life. And I think it's very important that America be led by people that don't appear to the vast majority of Americans as kind of completely out of touch with what's going on in their lives. And there is no matter what Trump and Vance try to do to Tim Walls, they're not going to be able to take that away from him. He is somebody that truly is relatable because he understands the way people live. And I think that was one of the big appeals of Joe Biden, despite the fact that Biden has spent his entire adult life since he was 29 years old, and he is famously no longer that, in government service with a couple of years off in between his vice presidency and presidency. He grew up in Scranton with a family that struggled economically, and he did understand how people live. And I think having somebody like that on the ticket is very, very important.
And I think of various policies that Democrats, progressives value. And I think they tend to forget that these are issues in middle America. I once talked to Amy Klobuchar about the child care deserts in the Middle West in rural America, that it's really hard to find child care in an area that is not densely populated. Is it in those areas, in policy areas as well, that he might be able to demonstrate to voters that, hey, Democrats can do something for you. We have ideas that might make your life better, as opposed to simply being a culture warrior for whatever grievances and problems they might have.
Yeah, I do think he can do that. And look, what we've seen in politics is there is a middle ground between what is essentially frivolous baloney. So Democrats are coming for your plastic straws. Okay, people don't like non-plastic straws, but it isn't going to affect anybody's life. And things that are so abstract that people don't understand how it's going to affect them or their communities. Like the Inflation Reduction Act is fantastic, is a great piece of legislation, but it is kind of hard to explain to people who don't pay a lot of attention to public policy why it matters to them. I think Walz can find the middle ground between those things that are too small or too large and talk to people about things that they really do struggle with. And you pointed to one, there's many of them. Another one, for example, on the other end of the age spectrum is caregiving for seniors. That is a huge, enormous issue. My own family has encountered that recently. And we're very fortunate, but a lot of people can't afford to bring in help with their families. And it is an crushing burden for so many Americans. And I think what Tim Walz can do is at a town hall meeting or in an interview with local press or one-on-one can really relate to people about the things that they care about and that are really causing the biggest burdens for them in their lives.
Back up a little bit and talk about the Harris campaign in general. They've done something that is somewhat gobsmacking, actually, which is they've only been in this race for what, less than 3 weeks? And they basically have turned around the mood of the party, turned around the campaign kind of structure, changed the trajectory of the polls, even if you don't think polls are all that accurate even now, gotten themselves a VP. How did they do this? Is it the personnel they have? Is it the organic enthusiasm from the grassroots? What explains this spasm of competence that we don't always see from Democrats?
I think that it's everything. I mean, there's no question that they're benefiting from a huge wave of relief and excitement that we've gone from a candidate who pretty clearly was going to have a hard time competing with Trump to one that obviously can. And because Trump is the threat that he is, Democrats are just elated in ways that we haven't been in a long time. But to their enormous credit, they have surfed that momentum brilliantly. I also want to point out that campaign staff generally is very, very competent and good, and they get too much credit when they win and far too much blame when they lose. And mostly they just do their jobs pretty well. And I think what you're finding is the same people who were the goats when Biden was really struggling, and now the heroes, now that Kamala is riding high. The fact is they're very good at their jobs. They were good at their jobs before. They're still good at their jobs, and they've handled this rollout very well.
One of the changes obviously comes from the top of the ticket, and that is the kind of social media presence, the vibe, kind of the joyful, happy warrior, but kind of the contemporary, like, this is fun. Let's go have some fun. Let's skewer these other guys. We saw none of that during the Biden tenor of his candidacy. Do you think that's a specific choice of the staff, or do you think that's just playing off the personality of the candidate who's running?
Well, I think it was very deliberate. And what they clearly did, and you could see this in her speeches right away in the very first ad that they dropped, was they changed the entire narrative framework of the campaign. The Democrats went from having the old guy in the race to having the young person in the race. And by the way, as a 59-year-old, I must say the greatest thing about this is that 59 is now super young.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah.
I applaud the vice president for making that happen. But they now have youthfulness, energy, and future-oriented. And to go with it, they have matched that with a kind of optimistic, excited vibe. And I think Walz fits that perfectly. I mean, the reason that he shot up the charts in vice presidential odds making was because he went on television and started talking about Vance, not as being racist and horrible and sexist, but as just being weird. The guy's weird. And that has stuck to Trump and Vance like a leech. And the Harris team has done a brilliant job of maintaining that. And so they have, it's been a virtuous cycle where they've gotten a lot of breaks because of the momentum behind them, but they've managed all of those to perfection.
The strategic choices they've made is one that Bill Clinton and Al Gore made, although they did it after the convention, and this pair is doing it before, which is to go as buddies, go together on, I don't know if they're going to travel by bus or by plane, but they're going to do a tour of the battleground states. What did that do for Clinton/Gore, and what do you think it can do for the Harris-Walz ticket?
Yeah, in 92, the Clinton-Gore campaign invented the bus trip that had not been used in politics in a long time. And I happened to be back then an advanced guy, and I was in the very first stop in Pennsylvania of that bus, of that first bus trip. And it was at a union hall. I will never forget the feeling when the two of them walked into that hall. It was like someone shot an electric current through everyone, like the hairs on your arm stood up. It was incredible. And I had worked prior to that, 4 years prior, on the Dukakis campaign. And while I revere and love Mike Dukakis, that feeling never happened on the Dukakis, not one time, never. So the chemistry is real. And I believe that Walz's nature is going to allow them to have that kind of fun and charismatic momentum that they carry into and out of the convention. And the fact is, no convention has ever been this late in the cycle, which is working perfectly because the momentum can really carry into the early voting that starts in September.
One of the things that I always have to kid you about, because everyone kids you about, is you were the Dukakis guy and you did have the helmet in the tank moment. You, in your usual self-deprecating humor, said, helmets are bad, baseball caps are good. What did you mean by that?
So just to explain, I was the sight advance guy when Mike Dukakis rode around in a tank. He wore a helmet and he looked horrible. He looked like Snoopy. And the Bush campaign immediately put up an ad that was devastatingly effective. So here's what not to do if you're a campaign staffer. Right. However, I was responding in that tweet you described to some pictures of Walz wearing ball caps because he can wear them really naturally. Dukakis actually had served in the military. He was in war in Korea, actually, but he just looked weird in that helmet. And Walz looks right at home. He could walk into a Cabela's and completely comfortably. And so it's all about authenticity. If you can do what you're doing in a way that feels authentic, then do it. And if you can't, then don't. And that was the big problem with the tank.
When you're going out on a tour like this, what's your aim? Are you looking for kind of vista shots that you can use in ads? Are you looking to get in touch with local media? What are your aims when you go out on a tour like this?
So there's several things that you want to achieve. One is you definitely, I would guarantee they have their ad teams filming at some of these venues, the ones that are going to be the loudest, the most exciting, the most, the most crowd feedback. They may do some town hall meetings where they can get empathetic moments happening. They also want to rev up the volunteers in those areas. One thing campaigns have learned is it is great to have volunteers from Brooklyn, you know, wanting to help you as a Democrat. But you really need people from Scranton to knock on doors in Scranton. And so these kinds of tours generate a bunch of names for the campaign of people that they can tap to help them with phone banking and door knocking. And then, of course, you want to get local media coverage. Most Americans get their news from sources other than, I hate to say it, the Washington Post.
Absolutely.
I'm a proud subscriber, but they get it from local news. And when you do these kinds of tours, you're guaranteed coverage on the local news, and that's very helpful as well.
When you go out on one of these tours and you kind of interact with the crowd, sometimes I would imagine this kind of changes your approach. You're getting inputs at the same time. In this case, I wonder if it's, again, a real advantage to do this before the convention, because after getting all these inputs, after getting all this, they can then kind of absorb that and talk about that at the convention. I don't remember another opportunity to do that. That kind of gives it a little bit more authenticity instead of this weird, very sterile, artificial kind of event that we've gotten used to at TV conventions, which is essentially what they are, TV shows.
I think that's a great point. And, you know, it's kind of like a comedian that kind of works out their routine. They do it 3-4 times a night, and they work the kinks out. They find where the beats are and the laugh lines. It's the same thing. And one thing you got to say for Harris is she has been sharp in her stump speech. I think it is 13 minutes long. Trump's is 92 minutes long, give or take 15 minutes, plus or minus. And she knows where the beats are, and she lands them. And that is very important, because as they add them, as circumstances change, they will be able to weave some of those into the convention speech, which a lot of people are going to watch, which she will be graded on, which will be part of the conversation for a long time. So I think you're right that this is very helpful as they move towards the convention. And let me just say one other thing about what they've been doing out there. When I watched the Atlanta speech, I watched it carefully for one very important thing. Megan Thee Stallion was there, the hip-hop star. And I wanted to know, was that her crowd or Harris's crowd? Because when John Kerry used to appear with Bruce Springsteen in Philadelphia, that was Bruce's crowd. Let's just be clear. I like John Kerry. I was a big supporter. But those people were there to see Bruce. That was not the case in Atlanta. They were there to see Kamala. And that's very important.
Democrats usually have the advantage of having celebrities, pop people involved, but there's always this two-edged sword, and Biden got a little bit, I think, in trouble in it, in that you don't want to be seen as a creature of Hollywood. You don't want to have, you know, the big stars be your image of, you know, who your supporters are. That would seem to be another way in that Walz helps, is that I suspect he's never met a celebrity other than, you know, perhaps accidentally on the street, so that his people look like, you know, ordinary people as opposed to Hollywood stars. You know, he doesn't live in Brentwood, California, which is a very ritzy neighborhood of Los Angeles, the way Harris does. So he brings different friends with him. And I would think that that helps in some respect as well.
100%. Nobody looks at Tim Walz and thinks like, I bet Katy Perry was at his birthday party. You know, like, it's just not how he rolls. But I do think having the best of both worlds is great, because Harris does have a little of that. She's got some star power the way Obama did. She looks like stars want to hang out with her.
Yes.
And not like she's eager to hang out with them, which was sometimes the case with Democrats who use stars to generate crowds. Walz looks like he couldn't care less and would much rather, you know, talk football with somebody around a barbecue than go to one of those parties.
We're going to have a very, I don't want to say strange, but I would say emotional convention, because you're going to have this real passing of the baton. Oh. Biden is due to come on the first night, on Monday night, and then we'll kind of go off. What do you expect that to be like? He was much beloved. He's given his life to this party and to the country. The campaign kind of was obviously not his finest moment, but his giving up the campaign may have been his finest moment. What do you think he's going to say, and what do you think the reaction to him in the hall is going to be?
I think the House is going to come down. I mean, to your point, Democrats love Joe Biden right now. I mean, they loved him before. They were nervous about him for a long time, and now they seriously love him again. Because especially if Harris wins and we don't have the catastrophe of Trump again, Joe Biden will go down in history as one of the best presidents of the modern era and maybe of all time. There weren't a ton of great 19th century presidents other than Lincoln. So he'll be right up there. And
yes.
And I think Democrats really understand that. And Americans haven't come around to that point of view yet because they're struggling with inflation and they don't see the benefits of all the things that Biden accomplished, but they will. And people who pay close attention, the people in that hall really know. So I think it's going to be an explosion of emotion for Biden. And if he plays his cards right, and I really hope he does, and he is completely gracious about Harris, which I'm sure he'll be, and he is appropriately he does the right amount of looking back at his own record without too much, then I think it'll just be perfect for him.
And what about her speech? Obviously, her speech, Wallace's speech are going to be the big sort of audience getters. What do you think she needs to do at the convention, either to kind of quell some doubts or to reassure people or simply to rev up the people who are already in her corner? If you were giving her kind of beats of the speech, what things should she be aiming to do?
Well, the thing that she's extraordinarily gifted at is prosecuting the case against Trump. And there's going to be a bunch of that in the speech. And there has to be, because this has got to be a choice and not a referendum on her. And they are well aware of that. And it's a huge part of their stump speech. So I think she will put the hammer to Trump in a very effective way. She always does. And of that, I have no doubt or concern. The real question is, how does she handle her vision for the future? Because as we've said, she does want to make this about a positive, optimistic vision of America and of the future, to contrast with the kind of negativity that we saw after the first 20 minutes of Trump's own speech. And so my guess is, especially with Walls on the ticket now, is that she basically says, this is the greatest country in the world. Anyone who tells you otherwise is a liar or wrong. Things aren't perfect. There's a lot of work to be done. I am committed to doing it, but America is going to come out on top no matter what the things that we face going forward, either internationally or domestically. We can handle it because we are the greatest country on earth. So I think an optimistic patriotism will be the kind of centerpiece of her speech.
Now, Democrats have traditionally been weak on a few issues. One is crime and the other is immigration. On crime, although people don't believe it, we're at a near 50-year low. On immigration, thanks to the executive order that was necessary because Trump tanked the immigration bill, we're seeing plunging rates at the border. You can tell people that, and they may not really believe it or understand it. Mm-hmm. What's the best way for her and for Walls to present that to the American people? Why you should trust them on those two issues that a lot of voters legitimately care about?
Right. And I think a couple of things have led to this perception that Democrats are weak on those issues. Some of them are real and substantive, and some of them are made up. The real substantive thing on immigration was there was a crisis at the border for a really long time until the executive order was passed. And you could argue, I think persuasively, that Biden maybe waited a little too long to take that action. To be fair to the president, though, and to her, to Harris, they were trying to cut a deal, which they then did cut with Jim Lankford of Oklahoma, a very conservative, tough on immigration Republican, a very good deal that for a moment looked like it was going to be the answer to this problem and would be. But as you say, Trump tanked it because all he cares about is himself. And he was worried that this would hurt his ability to use this as a wedge issue in the campaign. So I think on immigration, what they have got to make clear to people is the stereotype of her as an open borders liberal is complete nonsense, that she has been extremely tough, that she will continue to be tough, but she will be tough within the bounds of what is acceptable behavior in America. And that does not include tearing babies out of the arms of their mothers at the border. It does not include throwing children into chilled cells and sending them off without a trace so that they cannot be reunited with their families. And it doesn't include establishing giant camps to deport people in through some kind of mass deportation plan, the way that the Project 2025 talks about. So I think she needs to contrast her vision for a orderly border against the kind of barbaric vision that Trump and Vance offer. And then on crime, I think it's relatively similar. Democrats were hurt by the perception that we wanted, for example, to defund the police, a thing that, you know, began with the crisis in Minneapolis. But that is ancient history. Democrats don't want to do that. No, most Democrats, very much including Harris and Walz, never wanted to do that. And so we need to make clear that orderly and safe communities are an enormously important priority for this ticket, and that they will do the things necessary to do to make sure that crime stays under control, continues to go down. And they will puncture some of the myths that the Republicans are telling about crime. I mean, the problem is that conservative media uses anecdotes rather than data. So they constantly harp on the same, you know, one horrible murder, which, while terrible and regrettable, is a very small part of American life. And they ignore the fact that for most Americans, our cities are much, much safer.
I would expect as well that she's going to play the prosecutor versus predator card.
Indeed.
She's already started doing that.
Right.
And she's going to get up there and say, you want to lecture me, a prosecutor who put these creeps in jail? You, Mr. Convicted of 34 counts of crime? That's perhaps a rhetorical response, if not a substantive response, but it kind of might work, because I think they want to hear from a Democrat that this is someone who put people in jail, that she's not allergic to prosecuting criminals and treating them like they should be put away if they're a danger to society.
100%. I mean, her signs, her slogan when she ran for president in 2020 was "for the people." And the reason, that's because the first thing you say when you stand up in court as a prosecutor is, "I'm Kamala Harris for the people." And that is who she is at her core. She is a prosecutor, and he, at his core, is a criminal. He always yes. has been. He's only recently been convicted, but he's also an adjudicated rapist. He's an admitted sexual predator. I mean, he is a bad person, and she is the good guy. And I think you're exactly right. She's got to make that clear.
One of the things I did recently, and full disclosure, I went to Third Way to get some data, because you guys are a great data shop, was to look at some of these issues that Republicans say are liberal or kind of fringe issues. And what I discovered is things like protecting Medicare and Medicaid, investing in green energy, access to abortion. These are not only popular issues, these are like 70% and above issues, that what has been painted as kind of fringe is much more mainstream than Republicans and right-wing media would have people understand. You guys are known as kind of the moderate Democratic policy shop. That's what Third Way is. How do you kind of explain that to people and embrace where Democrats are? A lot of times they talk about moving to the center. How much of that is moving, and how much of that is explaining where you already are and explaining why that's popular?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Look, I think there has been some moving. Let's just be clear. When Kamala Harris ran for president last time, she took some positions that we didn't like as the center left on things like banning fracking and some stuff on immigration and other things, Medicare for all, for example. She has repudiated all of that, and so that has been a shift, but not in her principles, not in the ends that she seeks to achieve, but in the means, in the policy ideas. And in our view, at least, good politicians shift their policy proposals and their means all the time to meet reality, whether it's legislative, political, mores of the country, what have you. They do not shift their principles. Principles should be forever. Bad and craven politicians, like, say, J.D. Vance, change their principles to get elected to office. And what Harris has done, for example, on, let's say, on clean energy and climate change, has said, look, I still believe there's a climate crisis and that we must move to clean energy, not only to meet that, but to lead the world in this giant new market. I just think that we can do it in different ways. I've been vice president for 3.5 years. We passed into the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS bill and the infrastructure bill. And those are the ways, making clean energy cheap is the way I want to approach it now, because I've learned a lot talking to people traveling the country. She's learned a lot about how to protect people's affordable health care through the ACA rather than Medicare for All. She's learned a lot about how best to handle the immigration issues. Learning and growing is good in politicians. Contorting yourself to your new political master and changing your principles to do so is bad. And I think it's very important for folks like us to applaud her when she moves to the center, to a place that is more widely accepted by Americans and we think better public policy, and not condemn her for once having positions that we didn't agree with.
One issue that you've been intimately involved in well before your days at Third Way is the gun safety issue. And here it would seem that the caricature that Republicans put out there should be really easy to puncture. First of all, Rawls is a gun owner and he's a hunter. He's probably the only one of the four who really is comfortable with guns and has shot something, and something that's not human. When she goes to say to people, "I'm not here to grab your gun. I'm here to have universal background checks. Oh, 70% issue. I'm here to ban assault weapons. Maybe a 60% issue." Does Walls help her with that? Does she make some headway with those people? Those are really popular positions. And because of our screwed up political system, we never get the kind of gun legislation that is overwhelmingly popular out there.
Exactly. Guns are one of those issues that have a lot of agreement, but low salience for most people. So as you say, virtually everybody agrees that we should, if you buy a gun, you should go through a background check. If you ask a question that way, you get about 95% of respondents agreeing. There are single issue gun voters. Almost all of them vote for Republicans because they believe that the rhetoric that they hear from the gun rights community that somehow Democrats are going to take away their guns, which is obviously nonsense. Every time a Democrat is elected president, gun sales go through the roof. There's now at least 450 million guns in private hands in the United States. We don't know for sure because nobody keeps track. We know that from polling. 450 million guns. No one's coming to your house to take away 450 million guns. What we want to do as Democrats, and there is very broad consensus around this, is make sure that if you buy a gun, you go through a background check. These checks take basically 10 seconds. And they keep guns out of the hands of felons and domestic abusers and others who shouldn't have them, including, as we now know, people addicted to drugs. And so that's super popular. And then slightly less popular, but very broadly accepted, is the idea that weapons of war should not be in American streets. The problem, of course, is a lot of them are. Anything we do, even if Democrats, you know, got enough votes to pass a ban, we wouldn't be taking away the guns that are already out there. So it is a complete red herring to suggest that Democrats want to take people's guns away. There is a small group of voters that believe it. However, the thing that Walls can do is give comfort to not the gun rights activists, but to the people who see guns as a signal for where you are culturally. And I think Walls, in all the ways we've described, football coach, you know, broad-eating Midwestern dude, helps give comfort to people that he's not a weirdo. He's not a freak. He's not somebody that wants to grab your gun. He is a normal person who, you know, you're going to disagree some of things and agree with a lot of things, but he's not a weirdo. And I think that's the most important piece as it relates to guns.
Red flags are out there for Democrats. We seem to have a very illustrious record, and that's probably not the right word, of, you know, grabbing defeat out of the jaws of victory. Now, I don't even think we're at the point of victory because we've just dug out of the hole. So, you know, we're maybe like at level ground right now. What do you think going forward are the things to be wary of, the things to watch out for, the things to kind of avoid?
So, number one, for sure, is complacency. To your point, we are not winning. We are not winning. For a Democrat to be ahead, we have to be up by at least five in the national polls because of the way the Electoral College breaks down, and we're not. It's about even right now. So better than it was at the end of the kind of Biden campaign, not as good as it must be if we're going to win this thing. Number two is, so one is beware of complacency. Second, beware of identitarianism. I think one of the things that really bothers a lot of swing voters is this notion that Democrats, the Republicans call it wokeness, and I guess that's the term that has stuck. But really what it means is putting people into demographic boxes that they don't want to be put into, that they don't actually belong in necessarily, and that don't mean anything to them in their lives, and then condemning them in some way for being in that demographic box. And we have to be very careful not to underscore that weakness that Republicans have really made hay with, I think, quite successfully. And that means being careful about some public policy ideas that could help underscore that. And it also means language. I mean, we have stumbled when Barack Obama said people cling to guns and religion, when Hillary Clinton talked about a basket of deplorables. Like, those are the kinds of incautious moments that happen for the most part, you know, off stage, that can really, really hurt us. Some people have just compared Walz is calling Trump and Vance weirdos to that, but that is totally wrong. What he was saying is those two guys are weirdos, not their voters. The voters not weird. They're weird. And so voters need to think about that before they give them their vote. So I think those are the kinds of things that we really have to be careful about avoiding.
Last question, as we reach the end of our time, what do you think this does to the political map? What areas do you think this potentially opens? Where should Democrats not waste their money on? Back in the day, it used to be Republicans always thought they could win New Jersey and California, and Democrats applauded their efforts to throw millions of dollars down the drain. How is the map different, both in terms of which states and the parts of states that might be now gettable for Democrats?
Right. Every cycle, there's irrational exuberance on both sides about states that turned out to be fool's gold. And for a long time for Democrats, it was Florida. We were chasing Florida well after Florida stopped being interested in us, which, as anyone who's ever dated knows, is not a good strategy. And so I think we should stop chasing Florida. And I am pretty confident the campaign agrees. There are basically seven states that are even remotely in play. Three of them, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, are going to be the core of the campaign. And then the others are the real question mark. So Arizona and Nevada were falling off the map for Democrats before Biden stepped aside because the Latino populations there were really losing faith in him. That has changed dramatically. We are now much closer in those places. We're not ahead, but we're much closer. And so I think those go back on the board. And then there's a real question around Georgia and North Carolina. We won Georgia last time, of course. We have two Democratic senators there, but it's a very tough state for Democrats. And much will depend on Black turnout in that state, as it did in the Senate races and in the presidential last time. So if we can, you know, Georgia was very well organized by Stacey Abrams and others. If that remains, then we have a shot there, although, again, we're behind. And then North Carolina is the real wild card because the governor's race there is very interesting. The lieutenant governor, who is a Republican, is running for governor. He is the craziest person in politics. He is crazier than Kerry Lake. He is, Mark Robinson is a complete nutcase. He also happens to be Black, but he is as MAGA as you can possibly get. So he will actually, through negative partisanship, Democrats will come out to vote against him. That could help the top of the ticket as well. So we have a shot there. I think that's the most remote possibility. Arizona and Nevada are probably the most promising in terms of the states going back on the map. And then Georgia is a wild card.
And to reassure voters, Harris, Walz don't need to win them all.
No, definitely not.
They only, theoretically, they could win it simply by defending the red blue wall states. But obviously they would want some comfort, and you always want to have a wider map and make the other guy spend his money or her money, in this case, his money.
That's exactly right. The one small caveat is if we just were able to win Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, we would also have to win the second congressional district of Nebraska, because otherwise we'd be at 269 rather than 270. We cannot go in tied in the Electoral College because Trump would win because of what happens in the House, even if we have the House majority. But Walz is born in Nebraska.
Yes.
And that's a place we absolutely can win. And so we could win it that way.
Well, it finally took a stroke of luck to have the guy who can get the one electoral vote that would keep exactly. us from catastrophe. Thanks so much for coming on, Matt. This has been so much fun. No one funner to talk politics with. And we'll keep in touch, see how the campaign goes.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Matt Bennett. Wow. He is such a source of information and of perspective, not just his Michael Dukakis story, of course, but in terms of kind of giving the lay of the land. And I think what he was saying is this is a way to flip the script. Republicans have tried to insist that they're real Americans, that the rest of us are freakish or elites or unpatriotic. And what Walz helps Kamala Harris do is flip that script, say, no, we're the real Americans. We're the ordinary people. Americans are decent, hardworking people. It's the greatest country in the world, as he said. And it's you guys who keep running down America. It's you guys who keep propounding these wacko ideas that no one wants, these extreme ideas. And we're the ones who are kind of core America. We have American values. And that's not a opportunity Democrats get a lot of. It's very easy to paint them sometimes as urban, out-of-touch elites, because more Democrats live in places like New York City and San Francisco and Chicago, and fewer Democrats live in the heartland. But I think what Matt is saying is Walz allows us to go into those areas and to make an appeal, to give people some reassurance. And remember, all elections these days are won at the margins. No one's going to win this election by 10 points nationally. So we're talking about a few percentage points in one state or another state, one of those seven states that Matt talked about. And so if you can get a Walz to go into those areas in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Arizona, in Georgia, in North Carolina, and just reduce the margin for Democrats, instead of losing by 70 points, he says lose by 60 points or even lose by 40 points. That would be extraordinary. That would mean that electoral votes that were not previously gettable do become gettable. And remember, that means not only the opportunity to win at the national level for president, but it's also going to help the Senate and it's also going to help the House. Because if Harris and Walz get into Congress and they are facing a Republican House and or a Republican Senate, it's going to be a miserable experience. And they are not going to be able to do the kinds of things that they want to do, which is reform the Supreme Court, which is build on the successes that the Biden administration has. So I think it's going to be a fascinating race. I think it is going to be a really fun ride on the way to the convention and at the convention. So please follow along. We are going to start doing more spontaneous videos and other programming to keep you up and current with what's going on. We'll do that during the week of the convention, and we'll do it before on the run-up. So keep yourself alert. Look for our videos. Look for our podcasts. And please do tell your friends. I want to hear from you. Please message. Please ask questions. And remember, tell your friends, tell people who you're trying to reach. This is where you can get some really frank, really fun conversation about politics and about policy, and sometimes even about a history book or two. So thanks for joining us. Remember, tell your friends. They can watch and follow on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.